Thank you all for coming. Again, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV and Reason.com. I want to thank, first and foremost, I want to thank Discus, the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States, as well as Lagunitas Brewery for providing the drinks for tonight. And what we're going to do first is show a quick video that we released today at Reason TV called Randorama, the Long Shelf Life of Ayn Rand's Cultural Legacy.
Have you read her? Rand. Atlas shrugged. That's the one.
Yes, yes it is.
Few American authors have shared the initial commercial success, much less the immense staying power of Ayn Rand, author of the novels The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, and a host of nonfiction books that continue to sell hundreds of thousands of copies a year. A quarter century after her death, Rand is still showing up all over popular culture.
I ate Atlas Shrugged.
Earlier this year, late-night TV host Jimmy Fallon did a bit where audience members ate pages of Rand's free-market-friendly books for sustenance as the stock market tanked.
Give me two Fountainheads.
Wait, I'm sorry, you're getting two?
Yeah, what, I'm hungry. For knowledge.
Allusions and references to Rand abound.
Author, philosopher, and female comb-over pioneer, Ayn Rand.
This is the story of Maggie Rourke, an architect who refused to compromise.
Throughout the ages, the finger painter, the Play-Doh sculptor, the Lincoln logger stood alone against the daycare teacher of her time. She did not live to earn approval stickers. She lived for herself.
Reports in Variety and Hollywood Reporter insist that true-believing Rand fans Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie are very close to rolling film on an A-list version of Atlas Shrugged. In fact, half of Hollywood seems to be devotees of the one-time script girl for Cecil B. DeMille. Rand even has fans in Congress.
Ayn Rand does the best job of making the moral case for democratic capitalism more than anybody else.
In an age of massive taxpayer-funded bailouts and proposed tax hikes on the wealthy, people are looking for an alternative and finding it in Rand's work. Over the past year, The Economist and others have reported sharply rising sales of Rand's books. Never a critical darling, Rand's stock is even rising among the intelligentsia. Two new books, Goddess of the Market and Ayn Rand and the World She Made, take long, serious, and generally sympathetic views of her life and work. What's so appealing about Rand? And why is she hotter now than ever? We asked Reason contributing editor Kathy Young, who, like Rand, left the Soviet Union for the United States.
She carved out a very unique niche with that romantic vision of the individual, with her defense of capitalism, with her defense of reason, all of which really stands out in 20th century culture.
Her 1958 novel, Atlas Shrugged, has even provided a major meme of going galt. In the novel, the productive members of society, tired of creating inventions and companies that get taken over by the government, retreat to a secret mountain hideaway called Galt's Gulch. In a country where the government seems hell-bent on taking over everything from the financial sector to automotive companies to healthcare, more and more people are asking, why should they continue to produce anything if it will only be taken away via taxes, regulation, and destructive government policies?
Without getting terribly panicky about it, I think it is definitely worth remembering as a cautionary tale.
Whether or not anyone actually ends up going galt, this much seems clear. Ayn Rand will be even more relevant to the 21st century than she was to the 20th. For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie. As many of you know, a couple of years ago, or a year ago, Reason celebrated its 40th anniversary. We've been around since 1968, and the magazine was founded by a guy named Lanny Friedlander, who was an objectivist. He was a student at Boston University. So we have strong Randian roots in our. It's really in our DNA. It's why the magazine is called Reason, because of the kind of supremacy that Rand put on that value or that facility as a defining of human beings.
What we're going to do tonight, we're going to have a panel where Catherine Mangu Ward, a senior editor at Reason Magazine, is going to talk a bit about Ayn Rand and the American right. She has a review coming out in the Weekly Standard of the two new books out, Ayn Rand and the World She Made and Goddess of the Market. Veronique de Régis, who's a columnist for Reason, works at Mercatus, the Mercatus Center as an economist. We'll talk about Rand in an international context and how Rand was inspirational to her in France, which I guess is indistinguishable from many of Rand's dystopias. And then finally, we're going to have Patrick Reasonover, who works with Duncan Scott Productions, which has just released a great new restored DVD version of the 1942 Italian version of We the Living. And he'll talk a little bit about the context of that movie and then show a trailer of that film. So, Catherine, why don't you take it away?
Since tomorrow is an election day, I thought that it might be appropriate to just take a few lessons from Rand's life for politics, in particular in these two new books that Nick referenced, Goddess of the Market and Ayn Rand and the World She Made. There's this sort of heartbreaking cycle where Rand keeps trying to care about actual electoral politics and then just being crushed by the realities of it. I think that's a lesson we should all take to heart and just stop caring about electoral politics. Two stories. One is the Wendell Willkie campaign. This is, Ayn Rand really sort of facing down FDR, looking at the New Deal, seeing this kind of dystopian future emerging right before her eyes. And she gets involved with the Willkie Clubs, which are this sort of, button-wearing, door-to-door. She actually went to movie theaters where they were showing, promotional Willkie materials, and then she would stay afterward and answer people's questions. So I just want you to think for a minute about the author of Atlas Shrugged, although at this point she's actually very discouraged. She's sort of written part of The Fountainhead. She's missed two deadlines, and she's lost her book contracts. She can't get another one, and so she sort of sets the book aside and gets incredibly involved in politics, which I think you could build a psychological story why she might have chosen to do that moment of despair. So she's, she's in the movie theater, she's knocking on doors. I mean, just Ayn Rand shows up at your door. Holy Christ. So she eventually becomes disillusioned with Willkie. He is not, in fact, John Galt, which is at this point not even a sort of fully formed character in her mind, but definitely a kind of dream for her. After the election is over, she becomes part of the ex-Willkie staffers against Willkie group. But there's actually a brief period when the election is first over, and she's trying to keep the spirit of the election going, of this sort of free market candidate going. And it looks to me a lot like what happened right after the Ron Paul campaign, with people kind of seeing this momentum, wanting to keep it going, and then not really have anything to pin it to, being disillusioned and getting angry. I think there's probably some folks in the crowd here who have some personal experience with that, but she swears off politics. This is it. She's never getting involved again. And then Barry Goldwater appears many, many years later, and she can't resist the siren song of Barry Goldwater. At this point, she's sort of done an end run around the mainstream media. She has this whole huge publishing empire that's hers, with the Objectivist newsletter, the Nathaniel Brandon Institute. And I just want to read you two quotes from her. March 1964, Rand on Barry Goldwater. In a world ravaged by dictatorships, can we afford to pass up a candidate of this kind? She's super pumped about Barry Goldwater. By the end of the year, about his defeat, the form of the defeat was a truly shameful switch, the attempt to substitute the question of personal morals for the crucial questions of the age, and offering that as a cardinal issue for the campaign. I would argue that this is always going to happen to objectivists or libertarians. It's always going to be that the crucial issues of the age to an objectivist or a libertarian are not the issues that any mainstream candidate will campaign on, even someone like Barry Goldwater. And sort of as a corollary to this, I would urge us to also take Rand's views toward the Libertarian Party for ourselves, which were not especially positive, and instead do what Rand wanted us to do, which was to fall in love with ideas, to fall in love with with philosophy and novels and culture and to be part of a big discussion about where America should be going, but not to pin any hopes on some guy with a button on his lapel, and sweet Jesus, not to follow Ayn Rand to knock on people's doors in the name of any of these stuffed shirts. So that's my little Rand lesson for the day.
Thank you, Catherine. Catherine, by the way, has over the years published one of the most popular and infamous pieces on our website, which she trots out every 2 to 4 years, which is a principled argument for not voting. So just so you know, which inflames many people. And now we're going to talk for a little bit, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience. Veronique, do you want to talk about Rand in France?
No. I think so. Yeah, it is. Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here to kind of remember how I got totally enamored with Ayn Rand and how it actually totally like changed my life. I mean, 20 years later, or like 15 years later, I have to say I've moved on a little bit, but not that much. Ayn Rand still holds its very special place in my heart. I mean, the first time I imagined me, like way younger, in France, stuck was like, two people I know are libertarians, speaking the same language I speak. It's kind of pre-internet, right? So you can't really kind of like learn everything you want to learn about libertarianism. I just discovered that there's actually a way for the way I was feeling. It's called libertarian. And this crazy professor of mine says, you know, you should read Ayn Rand. And you're just like, yeah, sure. So I go to the local bookstore and they're kind of like, looking at me like I'm from Mars or something. So I go back and I say, what's going on? I mean, like, where do I buy her books? And he says, well, you have to write to laissez-faire books, right? And it's not email. It's like, write. So I am, like, you know, writing my letter with a stamp and all that stuff to laissez-faire book, which I carry in my bag for, like, at least, like, a month and a half because I can never stop by the post office. And I finally get my book, and it's With a Living. It's, like, the first book, because it's like it was the smallest one, and Atlas Shrugged got stuck at custom because I actually kind of forgot the ultimate rule is like if you get anything from abroad, you have to kind of pretend it's a gift. Otherwise, it gets stuck at custom, so you have to send it to someone else's address. Anyway, Atlas Shrugged got stuck. And so I get With a Living, and I read it like literally in 2 days, and I'm like, I know I should have said an evening, but no, the reality was it was in 2 days. And I was just like, wow, holy crap. I was totally in love with André, by the way. Leo really didn't do anything to me. Like, it would turn out, like, most of Ayn Rand heroes just lost on me. But, like, André and, like, the loser in her books, like, Reardon, the kind of half-heroes, those were the hotties to me. And so, anyway, I'm reading, and I'm just like, I'm feeling, I'm like, you know, I'm Kira. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Like, France is communist, and it's just like, it totally rocked my world. It was just like, I was like, I just can't believe it. Plus, it was short. It turned out Atlas Shrugged was also very long. And it's still to this day, you know, like 20 years later, it's still kind of the one book you can read over and over and over again without having the feeling she thinks I'm an idiot. And I mean, it was totally unbelievable. And like 2 years later, I had moved to the U.S. And I totally felt, this is the kind of how I felt living in France, where basically one person knew and had told me about Ayn Rand, right? Where I lived in a completely, what appeared to me like the worst statist world, where you're totally isolated. And even though it looks nothing like the communist regime that she talks about in Wheel of Living, you're like, this is me. This is me. I have to escape, right? And I, unlike Kira, I kind of made it to the border, maybe because France is actually not that communist and there's not that much snow. But I made it to the border, and for like the longest, I mean, this is the reason why, I mean, like, if you were to ask me like to label myself, you know, after the libertarian thing, I would always say I'm an objectivist. I mean, this thing totally appeals to me. And, you know, and because it was before the age of the internet, I got to kind of totally ignore the fact that she was actually had really bad hair most of the time, and that she had that kind of crappy love story thing, crappy blah blah blah. But for the longest time, I really did kind of like totally endorse all that thing, and I really think that it's because while it wasn't communism, France wasn't communism. It was statist enough. You know, the kind of like the, I mean, there's a saying in French that says a unique thought is kind of like the way you think, right? It's just like everyone thinks the same. And it just like literally totally rocked my world. And I will just can never forget. And for this reason, I just can't wait for my children to read her. And I'm keeping them in this like totally like communist regime that we call the family. And then one day I will feed them Ayn Rand. So that's my, I guess, the second Iron lesson of the day. Just keep your children in communist regimes, and they will enjoy Iran even more.
Thank you, Veronique. You know, one of the, I'm not sure if all of you have seen the recent or the most recent issue of GQ has a story about Ayn Rand, in it, which I happen to be quoted in, which is pretty snarky and negative towards Rand. But one of the things, and it's certainly one of the points that I tried to make in that story as well as in a recent review at Wilson Quarterly that is available online at reason.org/Rand, but is not just the transformational nature of Rand's literature, but the individualism, which is very much, I think, very much part of the 1950s culture and the pushing back against mass society, against bureaucracy and whatnot. But Rand, out of those writers, people like J.D. Salinger, people like Jack Kerouac, she, whether you like her or not, or whether you think she's a great wordsmith or not, her books, her characters are still alive in a way. I mean, that clip reel that we had, you don't see people really talking about Holden Caulfield anymore. You don't see people talking about Philip Roth characters or even Kerouac characters in the same way. And that's a real testament to something in her work that speaks to a continuing need and desire for individualism. And with that, let's turn to Patrick Reasonover of Duncan Scott Productions. Tell us about the We the Living trailer, the We the Living DVD, and set up the five-minute trailer we're going to watch.
Okay. Well, first off, thank you very much to Nick and Reason for inviting me to come here and let me show you all a little bit of the film. And thank you, Veronique, for setting up We the Living so wonderfully with your story. this is a movie that is kind of an unusual movie, and it's unusual that our production company owns and distributes it. And that's kind of an unusual story, and so maybe we can go into it a little bit in the Q&A. But basically, I want to just introduce a trailer and have it kind of speak for itself. It does require a little bit of context, because when you first start watching it, you ask yourself questions. Why is this in black and white? Why are they speaking Italian? Why are they pretending to be Russian? And what is that white Ayn Randish dialogue appearing in subtitles at the bottom of the screen? This movie was made in 1942 in fascist Italy under Mussolini. And oddly enough, Mussolini's son was a part of the green lighting process. It was later banned because it was made because they had a wartime enemy, Russia, and it was meant to sort of undermine them. But I suppose when it was enormously popular, they quickly saw that a criticism of communist collectivism is a criticism of fascist collectivism. And so they banned it and ordered it destroyed. And there's an interesting story that we include on the DVD in a documentary about how it was rediscovered by two of Ayn Rand's lawyers, Hank and Erica Holzer, and re-edited by Duncan Scott, my boss at our company, and Ayn Rand. And it was released in the 1980s in the U.S., it's been on VHS ever since, and about a month ago, strangely enough, at the same time these two biographies on Ayn Rand were being published, we released it on DVD. And you can actually get it on our website, wethelivingmovie.com, and also on Amazon. And with that, let's take a look at it.
guardi sempre le persone come se volessi vedere quello che hanno dentro.
Qualche volta.
Io non lo farei se fossi un te. Meno conosci la gente, meglio starei. A meno che tu non abbia nervi forti e stomaco forte.
L'io.
Quando tutto sarà passato e le tracce del bolscevismo saranno state disinfettate dalla storia, quest'inno sarà una magnifica marcia funebre. La marcia funebre dell'illusione rossa.
Sciocca. Cosa state dicendo?
Quanto vi pagano per andare in giro a spiare?
Lo sapete qual è il posto per le ragazze come voi?
Sì. Dove uomini come voi non potrebbero entrare nemmeno dalla porta di servizio.
Vedo che siete nuova qui. Dovreste essere più prudente.
Abito al quarto piano e le scale sono rotte e sdrucciolevoli. Siate prudente voi quando verrete ad arrestarmi.
Ma siete coraggiosa o solamente stupida?
Lascio a voi di scoprirlo.
Pensato che avrei potuto arrestarvi, portarvi dove volevo e prendervi. Non sapete quello che avete fatto di me. Giorni fa ho perquisito una casa, c'era una donna e abbiamo trovato addosso dei documenti. Si dibatteva sul pavimento nella sua camicia da notte chiedendo grazie. Ho pensato a voi lì, sul pavimento nella vostra camicia da notte chiedendo pietà, come io ne ho chiesto a voi per tanti mesi. Ebbene, le risi in faccia e le diedi un calcio.
Devo lasciare la Russia prima che mi trovi. Parto stanotte con un battello che fa il contrabbando. Contrabbando di carne umana.
Sai cosa stiamo abbandonando? Una galera, Kir. Un'immensa galera coperta di neve e macchiata di sangue. Dove si è condannata a soffrire per scontare una sola pena. Quella di aver avuto la sfortuna di nascere.
They actually literally filmed almost the entire book page for page. And so they wanted to release it in the United States, but 4 hours is like way too long for an Italian black and white movie with no car chases to be released. And so they cut it down to 3 hours and they removed some subplots and they moved the end. And Duncan told me that when Ayn Rand saw the end, it flashes up, you know, fine in Italian. And she looked at it and she said, "That is anything but fine."
Do you know the story about Atlas Shrugged being translated in French? Do you know that story?
No.
I heard that it was... Yeah, well, they don't. They have one, but they really don't understand what it means. But, I mean, they translated it, and they had a footnote with, at the beginning when it starts, who is John Galt, they had a footnote explaining it. And she was like, "That's it! Communist country, communist language," and that's why it's never been translated. I actually released.
And it's never. It does not actually appear in a French. Let's open it up for questions, people. And David, can I give you the prerogative of the first question? Here, wait for the microphone. This is David Kelly of the Atlas Society.
Thank you, Nick. Yes, I'd like to ask a question of. whoever would care to answer it, but probably Catherine, you. In terms of Ayn Rand's popularity, one of the things that those of us who have been longtime objectivists and also involved in libertarian politics have observed is that one of Rand's most distinctive points as a political, ethical theorist and advocate is her egoism, her defense of what she called egoism, the legitimacy and honor of pursuing self-interest. And because of that flies in the face of so many cultural elements, my sense anyway is that people have been somewhat reluctant to touch that rail. And I'm wondering, and this is a genuine question, whether your sense, having observed the movement and the rise of Rand and the year of Rand now, whether something has changed on that score and whether people are responding in part not just to the Going Galt meme or to the political defense of freedom, which has been there and been a core part of the libertarian movement for such a long time, but whether they are somehow getting the moral individualism, moral primacy of the individual, possibly in the face of the the intensifying assault on, in effect, the right to pursue your own life and self-interest.
I wish they were. Unfortunately, I don't see a lot of that. I do see there's a very fraught relationship between Rand and the right, which is chronicled in Jennifer Burns' book, and I think people are less troubled by her atheism now. That a big point of tension that would have kept Tea Party types in the past away from Rand was the atheism issue. And I think that the sort of moral selfishness, the moral elements of egoism in her are part of that. But, you know, I would almost say that it's that question, it seems hard to even anchor that to anything that's going on right now. And people have always sort of taken the chunks of Rand that they could relate to. For instance, I actually, there's a short story, which is that my existence is at least in small part owed to Ayn Rand, because when my parents met, which was the first day of their freshman year at the University of Florida, my father was an architecture major, and my mom had just read The Fountainhead. And she, you know, as many people did, especially at the time, thought, you know, it was a book about architecture. And that it had sort of made architects cool, whereas my dad always claimed that previously it had just been kind of like graphite-covered nerds. And partially as a sort of nod to this, when I was 15, my mom gave me a copy of The Fountainhead and was subsequently just utterly horrified to find that what I had taken away from it was not that it was a cool book about architecture, but the capitalism stuff, the egoism stuff, and you know, it was just a phase, and now I work for Reason Magazine. Joke's on her. But I think, unfortunately, I think my impression is that, you know, people in this room and people like me are the exception, and that what people are taking away from Rand is maybe, I guess to borrow her term, a sense of life, a sort of a feeling from the books that includes this sense of self and egoism, but that explicitly, it's not something that people are grabbing onto. Maybe you have a different experience.
I think that one of the important thing about Rand is like there are people in her books, especially in La Shrugged, like Hank Reardon, and there's just actually I think I see a lot of people like him, which is like I think more real, which is like, you know, people who are true, hardcore, hardworking, kind of more people, and yet kind of are attached to kind of things that she would dismiss as kind of a sense of family and loyalty and things like this. And I actually think that it's like characters like his, which I was like totally into, plus the pirate, of course. But I mean, like, the pirate is like who actually kind of like connect us to kind of a sense that this is actually a real world we're talking about. The kind of, if it were just made of people like Galt and Dagny, and it would be, and even Dagny actually has a foot in kind of the real world. And I don't think we're going to see people becoming more like Galt, or I think what we will what I hope we'll see is more people feeling like Hank Reardon and kind of recognizing this. And that will
let's
be
hope
enough.
They're more like Hank Reardon and less like Hank Paulson.
Yes.
Right? Let's go to another question somewhere in the back.
I'm going to go for a major reach here. And this is something that just popped into my mind since you got on this particular subject. I think throughout history, you know, you can't really know what people in the past used to think and what their conceptions of self used to be. But I've heard it said that Don Quixote was like the first book where they talk about, you know, really having a sense of self and being able to create who you are. Is there any thought or writings on sort of a continuum of that particular idea in human history, of which Rand would be at the new end of the continuum?
I'm an economist, so I really have no idea about people.
It's no coincidence that she wrote a novel, right? I mean, Don Quixote is supposed to be the first novel, and novels are about, you know, sort of almost can't help but be about individuals. And I think, you know, at the very least, you know, there's a straight line from the first novel to Rand's perhaps overly large conception of herself as revolutionizing the novel and coming up with a new way of using that old form.
That's a good answer for me.
Another question. Here we go.
I think everybody tries to make everything they see about them. So I think a lot of people think about Ayn Rand in terms of themselves and their time period. I'm curious what all of you would think about what Rand would think about this, of whether or not this is really objectivism, or if it's a watered-down, like, politically correct version. This isn't, you know, a diatribe. I'm just curious what you'd have to say about this.
I think Ayn Rand would hate the current Ayn Rand moment. She would hate all the Tea Partiers. She would hate the two new books. She would hate the fact that the coverage of the two new books includes the fact that they're written by women about a strong woman, and that's really interesting. I mean, but she hated everyone who was an objectivist. I mean, she hated everyone, but she also particularly hated other objectivists. And I don't mean to say that. I mean, she had a very, very clear, very, very specific notion of what her philosophy was. And I think it's actually a good thing if we can sort of take the Hank slice, the Hank Reardon slice, or we can just take a useful bit. But she would have hated that. I mean, she would be like blowing smoke in your face right now.
Let's face it. She was a hater, and if she were born in the U.S., she would have been born in New Jersey. Right? Right?
And I would say even Monmouth County, New Jersey.
Yes. And I have nothing interesting to say on this.
Another thing we do at Duncan Scott Productions is a project that we do with the Atlas Society, and that's the Objectivist History Project. And what I've learned from looking at the many interviews of people who knew her is that it really would have depended on what time, like which Ayn Rand. Was it the Ayn Rand after she finished We the Living, or was it the Ayn Rand after she finished Atlas Shrugged and that came out and all the reviewers were very scathing of it? I think maybe if it was the Ayn Rand who finished We the Living and was beginning on The Fountainhead, she might have been ecstatic. But, you know, where she's like the movement creator, probably, I agree with you.
At the same time, isn't it, I mean, it struck me after I kind of like made the mistake of reading all the Brandon books and, you know, that she kind of liked this kind of cult kind of movement, right? So she would have loved it. I mean, of course, we would have all have been banned, but she would have loved it anyway, right?
I can't think of a single fiction writing author that wouldn't love to have adoring fans surrounding them telling how awesome they are.
Well, and I think she would have at least been happy that people now know what her books are about. I mean, you really can't overemphasize the fact that when these books first came out, the reviews missed the point so robustly and so repeatedly that, you know, at the very least, when people talk about Ayn Rand now, they are referring to something that's pretty close to what she actually thought. And they're referring to this cluster of egoism and capitalism and rational thought and sort of romantic fiction. And she was a hater, so she would be angry in some way.
And she was paranoid, too, because she was actually really reviewed a lot. I remember a talk given by David Bowes, about how she was actually reviewed twice by the New York Times, and yet she kept on kind of talking about how she was ignored, right, or just kind of dismissed, which, I mean, if ever I were reviewed even once
by the New York Times. But Patrick,
I would have to write a book for that, sure, but... You know, if they paid attention to me once, I would be happy.
But Patrick is definitely right. There were different moments, and the earlier Rand would probably be totally pumped to go up on the podium at a tea party and get people riled
up. Did she get worse? Did she get worse? Did she get completely more like...
I think so. I mean, I'm sure there are people in the audience who could speak more to that. But
can we have another question?
David.
Yes. Well, let's just...
Yes. I'm somewhat curious, as I have to admit, not entirely a fan of Ayn Rand, though I have read both Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead. You mentioned specifically not participating in the political process, that Ayn Rand found herself, that it wasn't worth her energy, and rather to focus on ideals. Now, specifically the books... deal with, within the context of her novels, the characters, one of the core tenets is that they cannot compromise. They cannot compromise a single thing. When these ideals are translated into kind of a messy world right here, and especially a political reality that demands compromise or that is full of compromises, how do you bridge that gulf? How do you begin to take those ideals and move them into reality? Do you sort of avoid the political process entirely and just sort of go to capitalism, go to continually trying to influence the electorate? Or at which point do you, which point do you try and make your voice heard, even if it's not the ideal?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't claim to speak as a sort of orthodox view on any of these things, but my view is that Rand herself is a great example of how you can wind up influencing politics in a really serious way while not aiming at it. I mean, she was a cultural figure. She was about, she thought of herself as a novelist and a philosopher. She sort of found politics messy and troublesome and all these, requiring compromise and all these things that she didn't want to get involved in. But there are always going to be other people who can't resist the siren song of politics, and in fact, even Rand herself, right? She swears off it entirely, and Goldwater emerges, and she can't quite pass it up. But I think you shouldn't underestimate the ability to sort of just create a cultural artifact, to be part of a commercial enterprise, and wind up influencing politics and the way the world works without sort of marching up to Capitol Hill and holding up a protest sign.
I mean, I like to think of myself as pretty uncompromising. I moved from one country to the other, and certainly it wasn't out of communism and into, la-la land. But, and I just think there is a place in the world of ideas for people who will... call it as it is. I think there's a place for everyone, and I refuse to study a government program that I do not want to abolish. I don't ever want to come out saying, well, let's just reform this a little bit so it makes the government efficient. I'm just like, nah. I'm sure I've written very squishy stuff, but that's out of stupidity rather than, ideally, I actually think that we need a lot of people who are uncompromising. And this is the only way, and no matter what the cost, and obviously the cost is minor when you don't live in a communist regime where your life is at stake, and when you actually live in a country where there is such a thing as a think tank world, and there are actually libertarian think tanks, so there are people who are willing to actually pay your salary to say crazy stuff. But I just think that some people need to kind of stand up, against the drug war, against in favor of legalization of prostitution and all of that good stuff. Because otherwise, we just would live in France, like literally.
Patrick, would you like to make a final statement before we repair to a more casual conversation?
No.
Please tell us what you think about legalization of prostitution and drugs.
I think it's great. Absolutely. It's wonderful.
I'll point out that I think France is several decades ahead of us on both of those.
It's on that point.
Just to complicate things more. Well, I want to, we don't have to go anywhere tonight. The panelists, I want to thank them, and they're going to be hanging out. Let's continue the conversation. And please join me in thanking Catherine Manga Ward, senior editor of Reason Magazine. Patrick Reasonover of Duncan Scott Productions, WeTheLivingMovie.com, and Veronique Duregis of the Mercatus Center. Amazing. And if I can, again, suggest check out reason.org/rand. Every day for the next two weeks, actually, at reason.tv, reason.com, and reason.org, we're going to be releasing different RAND-related videos, interviews with people from Reason's past as well as the movement, and we're building up quite an archive of material there. I'd also point out that if you like this great 1973 special issue cover, you can buy it as a T-shirt for about $20 at Reason.org, so do that. It's all for a good cause, and I'm sure that Miss Rand, would particularly be offended if you wore her face as a T-shirt. But I want to, and then just as a closing thought, one of the things, again, it is fascinating that Rand, out of authors from post-war America, is really going through a boomlet interest, which is driven partly by her work and the vision that it continues to engage people in a way that very, very few authors do, but also because of events that are overtaking us. And she really represents a way through which a lot of people in this room, as well as a lot of people in America, and a lot of people not yet born, will learn how to speak truth to power and will learn some lessons about how to make their way in the world. And for that, whether you love her or hate her, whether you think she's totally right or partly right or not right at all, she's really contributed a huge amount to American culture of the past 50, 60, 70 years. And, that's a great thing. It's no small contribution. I want to thank you all for coming, and let's continue the conversation either in here or out in the main room. Thank you again.